Station number 8266.
Midge Pritchett Gordon, Reel 3. Indeed, it was after our days in Milos, where in the main we were used as reconnaissance, but then in conjunction with the Greek Sacred Squadron and raiding forces Middle East, we found ourselves playing more and more the role of a commando. So the time came when I had to make it plain to the powers that be that, in actual fact, my small section were now being used for something where their specific ability was not really of great value. It was on this basis, and after Milos, I got permission to go home and negotiate whether or not to leave the men in the Middle East or not. Obviously, we did other jobs. The Germans left mines in the harbour of Chios, and it was Jock King and myself who got the job of locating them and actually removing them from the bottom of the harbour before our own ships could occupy the harbour of Chios. This type of job we did together with one or two visits to lots of islands occupied by the German, mainly on a reconnaissance basis. But there really were not any real targets left for us, remembering that limpets are no good against wooden hulls.
What did the location of the mines in Chios Harbour involve? How did you actually go about it?
Well, this was a comparatively simple problem because it became known that by the senior naval officer present, who was a lieutenant commander. Incidentally, my Royal Marines were the very first unit into Chios, and we were given the job of everything after the Germans left. To illustrate the extreme chaos at the time, the night we arrived in our little MTL, because we'd been weather-bound in Amorgos and told to move, the Germans were unaware that the main force had been withdrawn, and a 200-tonner came in with 1,400 Germans on board in the middle of the night. I suppose through use and optimism, I invited them in with lights and all this. Lights from motor cars and all this sort of thing. And we stationed the motor cars around the quayside, let her tie up, and then found ourselves in the most awkward predicament. We had 1,400 prisoners and 8 Royal Marines. But we put them in the police station, and somehow we didn't lose them. But that tells you the state of chaos in Chios when we first arrived. And it was only a day or two after that when the powers that be in Alexandria started sending up officers to take over the problem that we became aware of the fact that the Germans had mined the harbour. There was nobody else to do anything about it except my section, in so much we were the only people with any form of underwater swimming equipment. So King and I made a survey of the harbour, or the main mooring area of the harbour, and from our dinghy located what we thought looked like the mines. And then it was a question of my diving and securing ropes on whatever we found. And we did find the mines, and Alexandria did send a man up to dismantle them after we towed them up onto the quayside.
What kind of mines were they?
Time device, very heavy, big mines. In my case, they had a sort of wooden casing over. They were probably as much as good-sized crate, 3 foot 6 by 3 foot 6 by 3 foot 6. And they had a dropping bar on one side, which was lucky for me, in so much that I was able to secure the rope on the bar, which obviously was something which they were usually slung on a ship.
Did these 1,400 Germans resist in any way, or did they seem happy to be captured?
The Germans had garrisoned the Aegean and Crete and so on with second and third rate troops, not really their greatest fighting men. And in all fairness, they could have no idea that when they tied up in Chios, there wasn't a horde of Her Majesty's forces in the place, in so much that there appeared to be a hell of a lot of lights and a tremendous amount of small arms fired over the bridge of the ship, and they were just instructed to come ashore, and they just gave in.
What was their demeanour?
In the dark, you couldn't tell. You couldn't tell. They just obeyed orders and remained with us, probably guarded by the local Greeks and ourselves, probably 3 or 4 days before they were taken away.
What were your relations with the Greeks like?
In my case, I got nothing but kindness and help wherever I went. And on several of the operations in which I was involved, I had an officer of the Greek Sacred Squadron assigned to me. For instance, in Bilos, when we spent 3 or 4 days reconnoitering the island prior to the landings, which removed the garrison from Polonia and opened the way for the full attack on Milos.
What did Greek kindness consist of?
Always they managed to provide us with some sort of food, which, when your tin rations are pretty low or run out, was enormously helpful. I remember vividly on one occasion they climbed down a huge mountain and presented us with a live pig on the marine MTL. But basically, fruit, fish, bread, which was enormously helpful, and water.
Did the Greeks seem to be divided in their loyalties?
Unfortunately, this was a great sadness, and we found ourselves involved unwittingly, not speaking Greek. We were often involved in a problem. In fact, on one occasion I had to tow a small kite back with men who were obviously on the communist side of the regime and hand them over to the authorities on another island. But we were too distant to understand exactly what the situation was. I remember capturing one kike in which all the papers were actually concealed in loaves of bread. But it didn't mean anything to us. We didn't know. And it didn't actually attempt to take any notice of what was going on. We only had our own jobs to do. But there was no doubt that there was a terrible international feud amongst them.
Was there any difference in their attitude towards resistance of the Germans?
Not in my case, or in the case of any operation we undertook. Not at all.
What did the Greek attitude towards the Germans seem to be?
The men who were trying to promote the communist cause in no way involved themselves in attacking any of the German installations at all. They were just intent, as far as I can make out, on getting support for their cause amongst the islands on the basis that they anticipated the end of the war and they wanted to come out top when it was all over.
How did they go about trying to enlist the support?
They visited all the islands and talked and bribed, but in no way did they assist in irritating the German or the Italian.
Did the Greeks hate the Germans, or did they have any affection for them, or what?
They always gave me an extremely strong impression of they loathed them. And they were very cruel to prisoners and this type of thing. But then again, I've been back there 40 years later, and I find that the main holiday visitors to the likes of Milos are German, which I find astounding. But at the time, they would do anything to assist you against the Germans.
What did their cruelty towards prisoners consist of?
It's much easier to remove a ring if you take the finger off.
Why do you think they hated the Germans so much?
Germans behaved extremely well in those islands, and it was only that they themselves objected so much to being given orders and not permitted to fish and all this type of thing. In effect, the curfew of their life and the privations of their life, they blamed on the German. But there is no doubt that there were a lot of Germans who gradually had sufficient intelligence to make themselves quite friendly with the local population. And I suspect it is their families who today go to the likes of Chios and Milos, Sifnos, Tinos, all these other places, because they have some form of mutual friendship.
Did you come across much in the way of the Italian presence?
No. You will find from the history books that the Italians did actually garrison quite a lot of the major islands. I know, for instance, that the book about Simi, you will find that the garrison was under command of an Italian. Simi, of course, is S-Y-M-I and figures in quite a lot of the books.
Did the Greeks express any opinion about the Italians too?
None whatever. One of the things I liked about the Italians was the fact we managed to capture one of their extremely fast motor launches, the MAS boat, and we used this as a form of parent craft to get us up from Palestine to our first forward base, which was Castellarissa, which was a ruin really. But there we transship into the MAS boat, and then it was a question of going 60 knots wherever you wanted. There were not too many opposition craft that could get anywhere near you at 60 knots.
What do you mean by a MAS boat?
The name MAS boat was the name of the fast motor craft built by the Italians, the captured boat I talk about. It was called a MAS boat.
Is that MAS?
I'm not sure.
When you say that you are adopting the role of a commando more and more, what exactly do you mean by that? What did it involve?
Well, it definitely involved us in coming ashore with quite a number of troops and engaging in sort of ground attack on, for argument's sake, again in Polonia, a ground attack on a garrison on land. Yes, of course, we were capable of doing it, but it was in no way fitted in with what we've been training to do, which was attacking ships in their own harbours. We were literally being used as assault troops. And this really was a waste of rather specially trained men. We didn't lose any men, but it would have been very easy to lose them.
Did you take part in that yourself?
Oh, I've been in the island for 5 days and actually arranged the whole assault, in so much that met the raiding party and brought them ashore in the right place and brought them back over the cliffs and put them in on the right corners of the garrison area and kicked off the whole operation, I suppose.
Can you describe it as far as you witnessed it?
Well, it was very over very, very quickly, because the surprise was absolutely total, and the garrison just surrendered, but they couldn't do anything else, really. They lost 3 or 4 men, and that was enough. And by that time, our people were inside the garrison and inside all their dormitories and bedrooms. And again, it was in the dark. And dawn came within 20 minutes.
You talked about the hideout on the Turkish coast.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe that hideout, what it consisted of?
Yes, it's very simple, really. There are a lot of what we term in this country sea locks, really. They're deep bays on the coast, and we used to use those to put in our Greek kike type of ship. A kike is a wooden sailing craft, fishing craft. And we used to put them into these deep bays. And make no mistake, it was particularly possible to find in the next bay over the hill, you've got the Germans doing the same thing. In fact, it was suggested at one time that we should play water polo against each other. No, of course, we were wrong. We shouldn't have been in that territory, and neither should they. But it happened. And a very, very sort of distant, unknown part of Turkey. I mean, nobody lived down there. In fact, I only saw one Turk in 9 months. He came down to see what we were doing.
He was an official, was he?
Oh, no. No. Peasant.
Did the Turkish officials interfere with you at all?
Not at all. You see, probably the base ship, such as a kite, probably wouldn't actually lie in those waters for probably more than 2 or 3 days, waiting for weather to come right or an aerial photograph to be taken somewhere else in the sea, in the Aegean, so that anybody in raiding forces, Middle East or ourselves, could then carry on with the next hop into the islands. They were just staging points, but the Turkish coast was used regularly.
What was your own personal role in the Leros raid?
No, I was back at base by then. I'd just got back from one of these abortive submarine trips from Malta out to Crete. And so I was merely sitting in my wooden encampment in Naharia, I call it, chewing my nails, waiting to hear how Jack Richards and his boys had got on.
Was there any problem from the point of view of sickness, or did everybody keep good health?
The only thing which caught us out badly, and it sounds a minor ailment, but it isn't, and that was sandfly fever. And sandfly fever really played a big part in stopping the operation which we were doing in Suda Bay, because A, the weather was terribly rough, but I think we could have managed that, getting out of the submarine and launching the boatsman. The fact that 4 of us out of 6 had got a temperature of over 103, I think that had a good bearing on what the captain of the submarine said to Alexandria when they they decided to call the operation off. But sandfly fever was a menace. You could feel really very ill.
Could you take any precautions against it?
I think we did, but I think we used to take some form of pill of some sort, but it didn't alter the fact that time without number we all got it. Especially in Malta. That was the only thing, really, and other than silly things like eating too much watermelon or something like that.
Did you used to use mosquito nets?
No.
You
couldn't really. I mean, if you were going to live in a mosquito net in your in your base billet, you would be that much more prone to be in trouble if you slept under a rock in wherever you were going, when you were likely to be away a month or 2 months.
What personal weapons would the crews take with them?
Minimum. A knife and a pistol. And that would be it.
Would you have anything in the way of a uniform with you to identify you?
Yes. We carried identification on even on our shirts. Rank, etc. But of course the camouflage equipment did not carry anything. If it was only under your camouflage jacket that you could be seen to be wearing khaki shirts and with NCO's badges or officers' marks, whatever you might have. So, yes, you were dressed as a soldier, a Royal Marine.
Were you then confident that the Germans, in the event of capturing you, would respect you as POWs, or was there any apprehension that you might be shot as saboteurs?
I don't think we ever had any doubt that we would be treated as saboteurs, because the opposition let it be known what would happen if we were ever caught.
What did they say?
That, well, we were actually working alongside a man, a very famous man called Andy Lusson, who eventually, he got 3 DSOs and 3 MCs and finally a posthumous VC. And we were told, but I've never seen it in writing, that anybody found with Andy Lusson or doing a job similar to him would be treated the same as him as a saboteur.
Did you have any suicide equipment?
None whatever.
You mentioned having to swim with a suitcase. How on earth could you manage that?
Well, the suitcase was built as a form of raft. It was an inflatable thing, which, if you can imagine, it's very nearly the same as what we used to call a flutterboard. One of the things I've forgotten to mention, and I ought to mention it, is our little unit was the first really ever to use swim fins. And the swim fins, of course, increased one's mobility and speed quite colossally underwater. So if you had this rubberized, inflatable suitcase, you used that as a form of board to rest on and propelled yourself with your feet on which you had your swim fins. So the suitcase was not in any way something which inconvenienced you. It was the exact opposite. It was really your boat. Again, it was awkward sometimes, but it was not an easy thing to parachute with, obviously, because of all the things that happened as the parachute opens. But again, because you didn't have to actually physically open your own parachute, the answer was you could hold it to you in such a way that it didn't get involved in the parachute lines. No, the little suitcase really was just an improvement on the backrest which we had on the boom patrol boat, which was The boom patrol boat was an explosive motorboat, which you could either fire, you should fire it either as it hit on impact, as it hit the target, or you could set it to fire hydrostatically, which meant that it dropped down 12 feet below the waterline before it went off. When you set the steering of your motorboat, so you pulled the lever and went out backwards over the stern of the boat and over the backrest. And the backrest was a raft onto which you had to get quick, because the explosion 300, 400 yards away would be extremely uncomfortable for you. So the backrest, which was wooden in the boom patrol boat, we merely adapted that and made it into a rubberized suitcase to carry the limpets and escape gear.
Did the suitcase contain anything else?
A very small amount of rations.
What would they consist of?
Well, some form of concentrated foods which enabled you to keep going for a couple of days.
What would be the maximum period which you could operate before you had to return?
No operation was ever the same. You estimated the time required. I mean, sometimes the approach would take much longer than the exit. And so you just had to plan on an estimated period for the operation, and then it would be a question of living off the land as best you could. I mean, luckily, of course, working from the sea, it was in some ways much easier to survive on very little food, because you could eat ridiculous things like whelks and some strange sea fish and this sort of stuff. But we weren't working in a desert. Luckily.
Did you have much training on what you could and could not eat?
Never had time to do anything. Today, that's a very big part of warfare, is to survive if left in some ghastly spot. But we didn't. Just entirely up to your own ingenuity. And hopefully you would meet some kindly Greek who would